In American jurisprudence, the way things work is if you're the one who's on trial, if you are being defended, then you have an advantage in that in every court case, in every trial, you are given the last word in your defense. In the ordinary course of human discourse, which at times I've been told leads to disagreement, that there's a certain impulse that rises up in us all. Kids, guess what? You know when you're in a fight with your siblings? You know what happens? Inevitably, the fight becomes this, where somebody says, "You did that." And you said, "No, I didn't." "Yes, you did." "No, I didn't." "Yes, you did." And it goes back and forth, back and forth. Do you know why you're doing that? Because you want to have the last word. And when it comes to the dying wish of people, or when it comes to those who are on their deathbed, there is the pretty frequent occurrence that people remember what their last word was. You know, you saw Citizen Kane, Rosebud, right? Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of all the Sherlock Holmes stories, the last words that he ever uttered were to his wife, "You are wonderful." Socrates, "I drink what?" For some of you, that'll be a way homer. You'll get that on the way home. Whatever it might mean, our last words have a certain inherent potency to them, a poignancy to them. We want to remember because the last word means something. For the last 8 weeks, we have been listening pretty much to one voice. He calls himself the preacher. He's more like a philosopher. He wants to dispense wisdom, and he loves to share, but he's as difficult to hear as he's willing to share. He is one who is certainly a believer in the God of Israel, but he doesn't quite take the same consolation in that trust that perhaps we are accustomed to hearing from those in the Bible. And you know what? That might be some of you. You believe in God, but you don't quite get the consolation from it that you think you might. Or maybe that's all of us at one time or another. Yes, we believe, but it's just not the consolation we thought we'd have. This morning, we are listening, in effect, to the last words of the preacher, his last word on things. And what you're going to find from the last word is that it's pretty much his first word and the every word we've heard from him at some point, like we said, Good Friday. But his is not the only word we're going to hear. Because inasmuch as it's his last word invites a couple other last words. In fact, there's another last word in the passage we're going to hear, which is sort of a metaphor, I think, for a human condition. Because every one of you, including myself, there's part of us that just wants the last word on certain issues. We want to have something definitive. We want to give the last word to somebody. And when we feel most in despair is because we can't find a last word for the things that matter most. We want to listen to the preacher's last word today, but we want to hear the other voices that his last word kind of invites and get into a little philosophical, theological scrum. And ask ourselves, what does the resurrection say to us about the last word on things that matter? So we're going to listen to four voices and what each of them have to say about the last word. The last word of the world, the last word of this preacher, the last word of his patron, and the last word of the Lord and of his Christ. It's a very brief five verses we're going to end this book study of. But I think we have something to hear from all four voices. Would you stand as we read from Ecclesiastes chapter 12? Ecclesiastes chapter 12, starting in verse 8 and going all the way to the end. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads. Like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They're given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there's no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. For those of you who have not been with us, we've been listening to the entire book of Ecclesiastes as much as we can. We do in 8 weeks. And though the Hebrew word Kohelet is typically assigned to the idea of being a preacher, as you've come to understand, he is more like a philosopher. He is one trying to weigh ideas. He is one trying to dispense wisdom. And much of the time that we've heard him speak, he's been out to challenge conventional wisdom. He's been out to take the wisdom that we sort of naturally accrue to ourselves over the course of our lives, and he's asking us to take a second look. But he wouldn't be speaking unless there was a lot of wisdom that naturally comes humans' way just in the course of life. That this world serves up all sorts of ideas that we want to sort of embrace and distill and internalize and then live out over time with consistency and continuity. So when it comes to saying, what is the wisdom of the world? What is the last word of the world on things? You know, you could boil that down under three broad categories. When it comes to what this world says about purpose, a lot of the wisdom says this: don't worry. It's only a matter of time before you find your purpose. Just be patient. The world says that. It goes for that. It encourages that. And we listen to that. But it also has a few things to say about diligence. That if you will just work hard, good things will come. Happiness is just around the corner. Strength is coming your way. Just dig in, stick to it. And you know, we hear that and we think, sounds like a good idea. I'll do that. I'll embrace that. That sounds like the last word on being diligent. We've heard in previous weeks that the last word on something like justice is sort of summarized by that famous quip by that Unitarian pastor of the 19th century who said, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. And we encourage ourselves by those words. We ennoble them. We remind ourselves of them. We slip ourselves into the slipstream of those ideas and we try to embrace them. And we think, yeah, that's a last word worth holding to. The world is always going to start dispensing ideas that it will pass off as, this is it. Take this. Use this. Take refuge in this. And we do, for a while. And then life happens, and we get a little hesitant. A friend of mine sent me a text this morning. It was a picture from his driveway. And the picture was of his garage door that was stuck halfway up. He could not get out. His car was not... He's done. He's stuck at his home for the day. And his wry little quip was, it is not risen. It is not risen indeed. At which he said, thank God for internet church. There is wisdom that this world puts out, and then life happens and you go, maybe I need to recalibrate my expectations. We're hesitant. Even with the last word of the world. And you know what makes us hesitant? You know what's helped us in being hesitant? The preacher of Ecclesiastes. For 8 weeks, we have listened to him come at all that conventional wisdom and say, "Are you sure? Is that really the last word on things?" When he talks about, when we start thinking about purpose, and we hear from the world, "Just wait, you'll find your purpose soon." Brothers and sisters, you and I well know that there are lots of people in this world who are still wondering what their purpose might be. Purpose is a luxury they cannot afford. They just have to survive. There is no follow your heart and use all your gifts. There is, "I wonder if I'll have clean water by the end of the day." Find your purpose? How very interesting. I'm glad for you. It doesn't always happen. And you know what? Some people who find their purpose, there was a study that came out recently that said those who are most passionate about their work, who find the most meaning and purpose in their labor and their vocation, they end up being the most exhausted, the ones who lose most of their life by the end of their life. That whole thing about purpose, you may want to rethink that. And that whole thing about diligence, I don't know who George Monbiot is, but he said, quote, "If wealth always came by hard work and diligence, then every woman in Africa would be a millionaire." For some, diligence yields a return. But to call that the last word on that, go to another continent and try that one. See how many people show up for that sermon. And let's just talk about justice for a minute. We've been before. If you think that the arc of history is long but it bends toward justice, then you would need to ask the 175 million people who died in the 20th century at the hands of despots. See, the preacher is out to tell us, look, I know, he's not here to say there's no good in this world. Goodness does come. He's not here to say you'll never find any delight around here. He's not here to say that every second of every day is an uphill battle. He doesn't say that. He hasn't said that. Go back and check the record. But he is saying to us, it's a lot more complicated than you and I and the world's wisdom and the last word on things might prefer to admit. And if there's anything that cinches his case, it's when he starts talking about death, which is pretty much every chapter. Because those of us that think about death, or the conventional wisdom on death, how it is just sort of a natural part of life, or as Disney likes to call it, hey, it's this one big circle of life thing, unless you're the prey. Death sharpens the way we think about life. That is its gift to us, but let's not kid ourselves. Death takes everything, and nothing will compensate for its loss. Not under the sun. Not in whatever else we might give ourselves to here. The preacher is out to say to us, it's more complicated than that. And while he has at times been all over the map, and whereas at times you almost think that he's bordering, he's even tempted with being optimistic, he is there to say to us, look, if you want to think long and hard enough about it, probably the best posture towards things is a measure of resignation. No, not crawl into the fetal position. But you're going to raise your hand held high in sort of a triumphant kind of posture? Yeah, you're probably not thinking as hardly as you could. That's his last word on things. Vanity of vanity. Everything is vanity. And you know what? You and I could embrace that. We could go with that. And a lot of people do. And a lot of days, we might embrace that unwittingly. But he's not the last voice of Ecclesiastes, if you were listening carefully. The preacher's last words are in verse 8. So who's talking between verses 9 and verse 13? Some call this guy the narrator. He doesn't disclose his identity. He doesn't share his name. Others think of him as sort of the editor, the compiler of the preacher's words. Yep, that's it. The way we've preferred to style him around here is that he is the preacher's patron. He's got something for us, and he wants to give us what the preacher has said. But when he speaks, you have to listen carefully. It goes pretty fast, and you still wonder, what's he up to? What is this patron out to say to us? But the first thing you have to notice is, who is he saying it to? Yeah, it shows up in a book, and you and I are all the beneficiaries of this wisdom. But you know who he's talking to? He's talking to his son. This is not a set of words that he's compiled so that he could go on the lecture circuit. This is a set of wisdom that he has sought to dispense to his son out of love. And you know what you really value when you take the time to try to instill it in those who are going to come after you. And that's what he's doing. He says, my son, in verse 12, beware of anything beyond these. My favorite novel of the last 10 years, for some of you who've been around, you know what it is. It's the novel Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. It is the story of a Presbyterian preacher named Reverend Ames. And it is the story of a preacher who gives birth to a son very late in this man's life, almost like an Abrahamic story. And so what he composes for his son is something of a memoir, because he knows that everything that he would want to impart to his son, he won't have a chance to, because he's going to die before his son would ever be able to understand what he had to say. And so he writes this memoir, and Gilead is that word. And so there's this inherent built-in poignancy to that novel. And he says any number of his things to his son that you could put up on a wall, like what we quoted last week. Existence seems to me the most remarkable thing that could ever be imagined. But he also says there are two occasions when the sacred beauty of creation becomes dazzlingly apparent, and they occur together. One is when we feel our mortal insufficiency to the world, and the other is when we feel the world's mortal insufficiency to us. And he says all this, also this to his son. Christianity is a life, not a doctrine. I'm not saying never doubt or question. The Lord gave you a mind so that you would make honest use of it. I'm saying you must be sure that the doubts and questions are your own. He wants to impart that kind of wisdom to his son because he loves his son. And it's that sort of feeling that we all should feel when the patron of this preacher puts forth these ideas for his son. What does he want to say to him? What does he want to leave with his son, that his son might find his way, that he might give assistance to his son in this world? He wants to tell his son, son, listen to the preacher. He's got something for you. The wisdom he has for you, though, it's going to sting a little if you embrace it. Kids, the more you get older and the more stuff that your parents try to give you, you're going to find out that you learn a lot of important lessons through pain. And so when the patron of the preacher says, wisdom is like goads. Goads are those little things, that these little whips that shepherds would use to sort of get their sheep to go in a particular direction. And it would smart the sheep when it gets hit on the backside. But a shepherd does that because the shepherd's out to protect his sheep away from the precipice, away from the quicksand, away from the hole, away from the predator. But a lot of the times, those sheep needed something to really bite them in the derriere to get them to move in a particular direction. And the patron is saying, kids, son, wisdom is like that. And the preacher speaks in that way. Listen to the preacher. But at the same time the patron is speaking to his son about the preacher, he's also warning his son about the preacher. He's saying, my son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. He is in some sense warning his son of the preacher's way of seeking wisdom. That there is a kind of search for wisdom that is itself counterproductive. Ask John Calvin. He admits to driving himself to a great deal of unhealth and disease by the way he took care of his body because of all of the study that he gave himself to. The patron is warning his son of the way in which one might go after wisdom, that there is a time in which you might seek it in a way that is counterproductive. But he also is warning his son about a way of seeking wisdom too. You and I, if we've listened to the preacher long enough, know that he is trying to sort of see through the subterfuge of everything, trying to find the truth behind the truth, or actually just to sort of expose the flawed logic of whatever the conventional wisdom is before him. I put a quote on your bulletin from C.S. Lewis from his book, The Abolition of Man, who said, "You can't go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. To see through all things is the same as not to see." The patron is in some sense warning his son of the way in which the preacher is always trying to see through things. If you're always trying to see through things, you ever end up never seeing anything. What then is the patron trying to get us and his son to see? Verse 12. The end of the matter is this. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. Fear God. Keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. The preacher has been a little bit more nebulous, a little bit more diffident about saying, God is the one who is in heaven. Do everything that he says. Oh, he says that at times, but at other times he's more like, God does what he pleases and I don't understand why. The patron is there to tell his son, you may have greater confidence in this God. And therefore you should fear him and trust in him and do his commandments. That's his last word to us. You know what, brothers and sisters, in our day, that's a pretty debatable form of instruction. Because there's a lot of people that are not in a church today who find the whole idea of religion toxic. Who would say that if you give religions enough time, at some point there's going to be squabbling, and then there's going to be fighting, and then there's going to be killing. And if you walk that path, there is no way to avoid it. Brothers and sisters, take religion out of the conversation for a minute. The preacher's patron has told us, fear God, follow him. But if you take religion out of the conversation, if you're a mom and a dad who doesn't believe in God and you want to say, don't listen to the idea of God, but follow this wisdom. Both those who believe in God and those who do not, in imparting whatever form of wisdom they're trying to their children, you know what happens in both of their children? A question arises in the heart of both. Whether you are called upon to follow God or called upon to fear any talk of God, both forms of wisdom inevitably bring forth a question in the minds of both kinds of students. And that question involves the word enough. In the very last song of the musical Hamilton, the singer is of Alexander Hamilton's widow, Eliza. She is remembering her husband's great gifts, great talent, great perseverance, great capacity to follow in the way of wisdom, and his untimely death. And she wonders, will his story ever be known? Who will tell his story? And in the course of that song, the question that Alexander Hamilton had asked himself repeatedly, not just in the musical, but in his real life and his biography, his question actually becomes his wife's question. And that question in the song is, when my time is up, will I have done enough? Who will tell my story? And the chorus of that song answers her saying, who lives? Who dies? Who will tell your story? Eliza's question, Alexander's question, brothers and sisters, that's yours and my question. Who lives? Who dies? Who will tell our story? And beneath all that, will I have done enough? When the patron says unto his son, "Fear God and keep his commandments," a son will naturally begin to ask himself, if not his father, at some point, maybe under his breath, when I come to the end of my life, will I have done enough to fear God and keep his commandments? Or to that child who hears from his parents, "Dispense with this whole talk of God, but follow in this way. Do this thing to justify your existence on this planet." Inevitably, that son or daughter will at some point at the end of his life ask themselves, "Mom, Dad, professor, poet, philosopher, have I done enough? Have I done enough to justify my time on this planet?" Whether you believe in God or whether you don't, the same question comes forth. Have I done enough? And that, brothers and sisters, I think you would agree, is a haunting question. If that is the last word that comes to you, then it is only reasonable and plausible that at the end of your life, you will be asking like Eliza did, "Have I done enough?" And that's why we must come to this day and acknowledge that we are listening to one other voice. We have to. The preacher, in its own way, is holy writ. He has spoken to us with authority, and God has seen fit to include it in the canon of Scripture. But inasmuch as he is speaking to us truth, his truth is part of a story. And it exists somewhere on that storyline of Israel's history, somewhere on that storyline that God has been pleased to write and to reveal at his time. But there is another point on that storyline that we're giving our attention to today. And it is a part of the storyline when it was unprecedented and unanticipated, when a man who died walked again and who called himself, "I am the one who is God." And he is the one who came to us and said to us, "I am the resurrection and the life." Alistair MacIntyre is a Scottish philosopher. And on the front of your bulletin, I gave to you probably his most famous words. He said, "I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I can answer the prior question, of what story do I find myself apart?" You don't know what your ethics are until you know what storyline you find yourself in. And if you think there is no story to this existence, then the sky's the limit in whatever you might give yourself to in the way of ethics. Jesus has come to us and said to us, "Trust the preacher. Listen to what he's had to say. There is nothing in this world that can fix what is broken. There is nothing here that can forgive all that we've violated. There is nothing here under the sun that can compensate for all that we lose in death." And Jesus will also say to us, "Listen to the patron. Yes, fear God, keep his commandments." Jesus is not dispensing with trusting or obedience, but he is saying to us this: if you hear from God, "Trust me and obey me, fear God and keep his commandments," and you ask yourself, "Will I ever be able to do enough?" Jesus would say to us, "You're asking the wrong question." Whether you and I ever do enough does not apply. Because Jesus has come to us to give us a new story. And that new story, at the center of all existence, I've seen most well put from something I read from Fleming Rutledge. She says this: "Imagine a person totally committed to your best interests, devoted to seeing you flourish, fighting for you against all enemies, determined to eliminate everything destructive from your life, attentive to every detail of who you are, never thinking of himself at all, but only you. That is Jesus in relation to us all. Sacrificial in life, sacrificial in his death. That's at the heart of his story. That's what accounts for all things. That is the story to which he is inviting you by you trusting in his death and his resurrection. When Eliza sings, when the chorus sings, who lives, who dies, who will tell your story? They're all asking this question. Who will you give the last word to? Who will tell your story? Jesus comes to us in his life, in his death, in his rising again, and he says, who dies? I will. Who lives? You will. Who will tell your story? Let me. I'll tell the story of your new past that is now white as snow. I will let you walk around in a story in which your present takes hope in the future. I will tell your story. I will retell it in a way that you never could. And so, brothers and sisters, despite all of our best efforts to find the last word in something else, despite trying to find our last word for ourselves, the question before us all is, who are you going to give the last word to? And it's this cross and the resurrection that began to take hold that says to us, let him tell your story. Let him have the last word. You will not be disappointed. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.